we're holding on Kuf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, the sixth line. In the Mishnah, we learned that one of the mitzvahs in connection with taking a mashkan is that you're not allowed to be touched on this a few days ago, is that you're not allowed to take as a mashkan kelim sha'osin behen oichel nefesh, kelim that are used for food. There's a number of opinions among the Shonim what exactly is included in the scope of that. We talked about the other day that according to Tosfos, for example, a plow may not be included in that because even though, of course, you're plowing the ground in order to grow food, it's not actually used directly for the food itself, so it may not be included in the scope of this din. It may be that the din only applies to something that's used directly for the preparation of food. On the flip side, there are Rishonim who learn that Kalim Sha'osin Behen Oichel Nefesh would include Kalim that a person uses for his job to be able to make a living. So the Mishnah had mentioned, now you have an example of Rechayim V'Rochev, which are the two millstones that work together. You have Rechayim is the lower millstone, Rechev is the upper one, and the Torah says you're not allowed to take them as a mashkin, and the Mishnah had explained that each one is a separate issur of its own, because the Pasuk lists them separately. Now, we had a machlokes in the Gemara between Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda about what happens if a person... So now, the Pasuk says, lo yachlo rechayim v'rochev, you shouldn't take as a mashkin, rechayim, which is the lower millstone, v'rochev, or the upper millstone, and the Pasuk continues, ki nefesh hu chovel, because by doing that, he's taking a soul, he's taking a life as a mashkin. So now, are those words, ki nefesh hu chovel, are they coming to include other kelim, definitely, because it applies not only to rechayim v'rochev, but other kinds of kelim that are used for oichel nefesh. Do they also, in and of themselves, constitute another lav? That was the machloikas of Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda. Rav Huna held that yes, and therefore, if a person takes it just the rechayim by itself, he would be chayiv two malchus, one for taking the rechayim, and one for ki nefesh u'choyvel. And the same thing with the rochev by itself. And if he takes both of them, then Rav Huna would make him chayiv three malchus. One for rechayim, one for rechev, and one for ki nefesh u'choyvel. Rav Yehuda disagreed and said ki nefesh u'choyvel is only coming to tell us that it includes other kelim and not that it constitutes a third lav. So the Gemara says, sixth line of Kuf Tes Zayin Amud Aleph, Tanya Kavasei de Rav Yehuda. We learn a braisa that agrees with Rav Yehuda. The braisa says, Chobol Zug Shal Saporim. The person took as a mashkan a pair of scissors that are used by Saporim. Now, Saporim on the face of it means barbers. First of all, Rashi explains, the point is that the scissors are, I guess they're not like modern scissors that are riveted together, and you can't separate them. We're talking about scissors like they had in those times where you could easily detach the two blades. Yeah, I mean, I guess nowadays poultry scissors are like that. Whatever. The point is that they're two kelim, but you need them together in order to do the job. So they're similar in that sense to rechayim v'rochev. Now, when we say over here, zug shal saporim means scissors that are used by barbers. So now on the face of it, it's not used for oichel nefesh. So the Ran, in fact, explains that because we're talking about that kelim that are used for oichel nefesh, the Ran explains that Rashi would say that includes kelim that are used for a person to make a living. Here we're talking about a barber makes his living with those scissors, therefore they'd be considered oichel nefesh. On the other hand, Tosfos explains, Tosfos over here, and a few blocks ago explains that no, what we're talking about is that these are scissors that are used, for example, to cut off the leaves from food when you're preparing it, and therefore they're actually used for oichel nefesh. They're used directly with the food. In fact, Tosfos earlier on Kuf Yud Gimel had the girsa not zug shal saporim but zug shal misparayim, meaning a pair of scissors of the kind that are used to, for example, cut vegetables. Or Tosfos mentions another possibility before you shecht the animal, you need scissors to trim the hair or the fur around the base of shchita so that you can shecht properly and so you can clean the animal properly. And again, those are used directly with oichel nefesh. Anyway, so the Braise says that if a person took such a thing as a mashkin, or he took a pair of oxen, where again, that's two kalim that are used together. Now, Rashi first explains that it means that he took the two cows together with the yoke that binds them together, which is also a keli for Eichel Nefesh, and then Rashi adds another point that the yoke itself was made out of pieces. Tosfos says we're not talking about the cows, because again, Tosfos is going to Shitasam that plowing is not considered Eichel Nefesh, so therefore they would explain that it means that he took only the plow as a mashkan, and in fact there are Mephoshim who explain Rashi himself to be saying the same thing. The Drisha on Tur explains in a similar vein that Rashi, when he finishes off and mentions that the yoke was made out of pieces, what he means to say is, in other words, much like Tosfos, that we're not so much focusing on the animals, we're focusing on the yoke itself, and the point is that like the scissors, it was two parts which are needed to work together in order for it to work. Anyway, the Braise says that if he does that, chayev shnayim, if he takes those as a mashkan, then he would be chayev double malchus, one for each blade of the scissors, and one for each part of the yoke or each cow, as the case may be. Zeba atzmev, but if he took either one individually, if he took as a mashkan one blade of the scissors, for example, then the Braise says, ain't a chayev ala achas, then he's chayev only one malchus. Ve tanya idach, now we learn in another Braise, that if a person took the scissors or this yoke of oxen together, you would think he should be chayev for only one malchus, because after all, the scissors are needed to work together, and the yoke or the animals are needed to work together. So you would think he should be chayev maybe only one. No, Talmud Loma. Therefore, the pasuk says lo yachlo rechayim v'rochev. Therefore, the pasuk mentions. Therefore, we can learn from the fact that it says rechayim v'rochev, from which we learn ma rechayim. So we make a mamatzinu, a binyanav. Ma rechayim v'rochev shein yuchodin. What is special about Rechaim Varochev? They are Shnei Kalim. They're two separate Kalim, because each one is a separate millstone. But Oisin Malacha Achas, but they together do one job, because the two of them together grind the grain. V'chayev al-zebeth ne'atzmev al-zebeth ne'atzmev. And the Pasuk is implying that a person is chayev separately for each one, by mentioning Rechaim Varochev separately. We also had a point yesterday that we learned that Tosfos pointed out, now on the face of it, the Vav of Varochev could mean and. In that case, maybe you only chayev if you take both of them, but we learned something that Marsha says on Tosfos, that since it says Vorochev with a comet under the Vav, then that's a special kind of Vav, so therefore, in other words, if it was just a regular Vav, it would be Virechev, so therefore that teaches us that it's one or the other. So therefore a person is chayev for each one individually. So the Braise continues, af kol dvarim shein shnei kelim yuchadim, the same way, any other time we have two separate kelim, for example, the two blades of the scissors, va'osin malacha achas, and together they do one job, chayev al zebef ne'atzmei, then a person would be chayev individually for taking either one. So the point is, Rashi says like this. So we actually need both Braises. When we say Tanya Kavaseh de Rav Yehuda, we actually need both Braises together to prove Rav Yehuda's point. Rashi says, because the first Braise says that he's chayev only two. Now, so far, that would seem to be good enough, because Rav Huna would say that if he took the two millstones, he'd be chayev three. However, the fact is, Rashi says, look, I mean, after all, here we're not talking about millstones, which it says in the Pasuk. So no, when Rav Huna says, Rashi learns, when Rav Huna says he'd be chayev three, would specifically be if he takes millstones as a mashkan, because then the Pasuk actually mentions rechayim, and it mentions rochev, and then it continues ki nefesh uchoyvel, and Rav Huna holds each of those as a separate isra by itself. When you have, Rashi says, when it's talking about a pair of scissors, for example, or the yoke of oxen, there's no question he can't be chayev three malchus, even appointed of Yehuda, because the fact is he didn't take a rechayim and he didn't take a rochev. Or you can be mechayev him on the basis of is ki nefesh uchoyvel. So the first Braise alone says Rashi wouldn't prove Rav Yehuda's point. On the other hand, therefore we need the second Braise as well. And Rashi goes on to say further on, so why didn't we just quote the second Braise only? Why did we even need to quote the first Braise? The reason is because the second Braise is telling us you're chayev for each one individually. But that doesn't tell us there might indeed be three malchus involved. Maybe, in fact, the Braisa is saying, yeah, you chayim for the rechayim by itself, for the recha by itself, everybody agrees to that. Maybe the second Braisa would be saying that you actually get three malchus because the third one would be for kinefesh or choyvel, which would be like Rav Hunan. So in order to prove that, in order to prove like Rabbi Yehuda, Rashi says we need both Braises, and therefore that's why the Gemara said this, and therefore Rashi had the Girsa, which eventually got written and printed in the Gemara, the Tanya Idah, that we have two separate Braises, and it's only the combination of the two of them that tells us like Rabbi Yehuda. Now that's the point of Rashi. Tosfos doesn't like that explanation, because then you don't really, among other things, you don't really have a proof from the second one either, and the first one either, and then the first one, Fakert, is good enough to prove like Rabbi Yehuda, because it's not like Rashi says that in fact only by Rechaim Baruch of Rabbi Yehuda would impose on him three malchus. In fact, it would be the other ones, and in fact, it would be the other kinds of kalim as well. So Tosfos prefers the girsa tan ve'idach. So the Gemara is bringing two different proofs. We have a braisa that supports Rabbi Yehuda, the first braisa that says that he's chayev two malchus. That supports Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that he's chayev two. Separately, the Gemara says, you should know, by the way, there's another Braisa that explains the rationale behind it. So according to Tosfos, it's not that you need the combination of the two Braises to prove Rabbi Yehuda's point. It's either one by itself would be good enough for the purpose. And the Gemara is just having brought one Braisa that supports Rabbi Yehuda, then the Gemara brings another one. Okay. Either way, then, the point is we have Braises like Rabbi Yehuda, and indeed the Halacha is like him, that if a person took the Rechaim Vorochev as a mashkin, then he would be getting two malchus and no more than that. Okay. The Gemara tells, Hahu Gavra de Chobos Sakina de Ashkavta Mechavre. There was once a person who took as a mashkin from somebody else a knife of Ashkavta. Now Ashkavta literally means of death. Like you have the expression, for example, Ashkavta de Rebbe, when Rebbe passed away. So Rashi explains over here that it means a knife that's used for chopping up meat in the butcher shop. So there's no question, obviously, that's kalim that are used for oichel nefesh. However, Tosfos Arosh, other Rishonim point out that the fact is that the Gemara is going to mention soon that people are makbid if that knife becomes nicked, and you don't really, if the knife that's used for chopping up meat, people aren't going to care so much about that. Therefore, he explains, rather, it means a shchita knife. Whatever the case, one person took it as a mashkin from somebody else. Also, a kameda abaya, so he came to Abaya to ask whether he had done the right thing, or they came to a din Torah. Omalei, so Abaya tells him, zila hadri, go return it, to have a klisha uchsin by uchon nefesh, because it's a keli that's used for uchon nefesh, you're now allowed to take it as a mashkin, but tokum b'din alei, and then you can come to a din Torah against him. And after all, he still owes you the money, so then it'll be like a usual din Torah where there's a toyin v'nitan. He might be moida to you, and then he'll pay you. You might have edim, and then he'll pay you. Or if not, then he'll swear a shvos heses if he's kofar hakel, because the shvos heses, the tekona of that, was made in the time of Rab Nachman, and Abaya is already the next generation of Amiroyim. So in short, Abaya is telling him, though, you got to return that knife because you're over otherwise. Now, we talked about, we learned previously, there was a question, when the person takes such a mashkin, if he returns it, is he undoing the issue that he did, and therefore is potter from malchus? Tosfos had learned that no. Tosfos learns as soon as he took the mashkin, he's already chayev in malchus, when there was hasra, of course. The returning it is not going to undo that, unlike, for example, when a person steals, where he's makayim, then the mitzvah, the heshev es hagzeva, by returning it. Tosfos had learned that here, the returning it is not in order to get himself out of malchus. Well, in Abaya's times, there's no malchus d'araisa anymore, there's no smicha, and they lived in Bavel anyway, where there's no smicha. But nevertheless, Abaya is not telling him return it in order to undo the iser. He's telling him return it because the fact is you weren't supposed to take it in the first place. And in fact, there are mafoshim who say, basically, that Abaya is telling him, look, you mistakenly thought that you could take it, so now, therefore, you weren't even coin it as a mashkin in the first place, so therefore, return it. So that's actually Tosfos themselves explain it. The guy took the mashkin not knowing there was an iser, so you can't be mechayev malchus or anything like that for it. He didn't even know that it was aser. Therefore, Abaya is telling him to return it. Meanwhile, the Rambam holds that even if he took it the Mezid, and he knew that he was what he was doing was wrong, when he returns it, then he's undoing the Issa, and therefore he's not Chayav Malchus. Either way, the point is, Abaya is telling him, even after the fact that you took such a mashgun, you shouldn't think, well, it's a mashgun, and therefore I can keep it. No, you've got to return it to him. As far as the fact that he owes you money, deal with that in a din toter. Rava Omar, Rava says, as far as the returning, sure, of course you have to return it. But loit tzorich l'mekam b'din ha'alah. You actually don't need to go to a din toter on it, because the yochol litan ad kedei d'meihim. Instead, what he can do is that once he was toifus, the knife, and therefore he is kind of muchzik in it, therefore he has a migui, he could claim that he actually bought it, and when we would believe him, so he has a migui now, so therefore he could swear, and he could collect up to the value of the knife itself. Ad kedei d'meihim, up to the value of the knife itself. So he doesn't really need to come to a din torah. So he does have a mitzvah to return the knife, but until he does, he can use it as a basis for sure. And there's discussion about that, what exactly the nature of the shvua is. One way of looking at it, but Amman points out, a migui is good enough to get him, but it's good enough to get a person out of paying money, but it's not good enough for him to collect money without, you have a concept of migui lahotzi layamrinan. We don't say a migui to take money away from somebody else, only to keep what's yours. Therefore, he would need to swear a shvua if he wants his money. Would it be a shvua d'oraisa? Would it be a shvua? Would it be a shvua hesis? But in any case, he has to swear, and then he can collect. So Rava says you don't really need a full fled. You didn't turn for that. You just need that. He has this migui, and therefore he could do that.
How is he going to do that? Because the axe he already returned to the guy. So he doesn't have anything to show for himself.
If he already returned it, then that's one thing. Rava is saying that if you haven't returned it yet, then wait with returning it until you use it as a basis for your shavua.
So you're showing it that I bought it, it's mine.
Yeah.
So you can claim. And I'm with the value of it.
Yeah.
And if he says no, I'm not going to give you it.
Then maybe he would have a basis to keep the name. But in any case, the point is that he could claim ad kedei d'meihim, says Rava.
Okay.
So if Abaya, the rest of the morning, asks Abaya, less like Ha'i Svara, what does Abaya not agree with such a Svara that when a person has something which he could claim belongs to him when really it belongs to the other person, and he's taking it for a side reason that he could use it as a basis for a migui. Maishna mehanhu izi the achli chushla b'nahodra. There was a case one time in Nahodra where one person's goats ate the chushla, which are peeled barley that belonged to somebody else. The owner of the barley grabbed a hold of the goats and took them into his rishus, the katoin tuva, and he was claiming that they had eaten a lot of the barley, and therefore that he needs to be paid back for it. The Omer Avur de Shmuel, and Avur de Shmuel says, which is a couple of generations before Abaya, now, of course, Abaya could have disagreed with Avur de Shmuel, they're both Amiroyim, but nevertheless, the Gemara is going to assume that Abaya is not disagreeing with him, and Avur de Shmuel said, Yochol Litan Ad Kedei D'Meihim. The guy who has the goats currently in his possession, the owner of the chushla, can claim up to the value of the goats. So he can't claim that if the goats are worth only $100, he can't claim that they ate 200, he can't claim and collect $200 worth of the barley, because we don't have a basis for saying that, but he has a migui that he could say he bought these goats, and therefore he could claim that if you want them back, then give me the hundred of the chushla that they ate. And so we assume that Abaya would agree with that concept as well. So why over here is Abaya not accepting the migui? So again, the migui is a migui lahotzi mammon. It is a migui to take out money from the other person. But again, first of all, we said that there may be a shvua involved. But second of all, anyway, Rabbeinu Yonah explains that what he's saying is that once he grabbed the goats themselves, it's considered as though he's muchzik in the moment. Therefore, we can't say it's migui lahotzi anymore. It's a migui for him to keep what he has himself. And there's more details about that. Anyway, the question is, why would I buy and not say that the same thing over here? The answer is, Hosam lav midi de oshle ulay guri. The difference is the goats over there are not something which is lent out or rented out. People don't lend or rent out goats. So what are they, if the other guy were to say, these are my goats, what are they doing in your possession? It's impossible for him to say, they're really mine and I lent them to you or I rented them to you, because people don't do that. Therefore, the only possibilities are they belong to me or they belong to you. So he's able to claim that I bought them, and if there's no edim that he took them from the other guy's yeshus, then we would believe him to say that they're his. As opposed to hocha midi de ovid la oshli with a guri hu, as opposed to this knife that we're talking about, whether a butcher's knife according to Rashi or a shchita knife according to the Tosfos Rosh, is talking about is something that is regularly lent out or rented out. Well, therefore, then now we don't believe him that he bought it. And we can show that to Sholach Rav Huna Ba'oven, because in fact, Rav Huna Ba'oven sent a message with exactly this halacha. When a person has in his possession, Dvorim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir, things that are generally rented out or lent out, we'll talk about it in a second, whether they're generally or whether what the definition of Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir is, but Omer, and he says, Lepuchin Hein Biyodi, I bought them, Eina Neman, we don't believe him because we say you're claiming that you bought it, but on the other hand, this is the kind of thing that you might easily have borrowed or rented from the other guy, and therefore, if you want to claim that you actually bought it, then you're going to need some kind of proof of that. Now, what are Dvorim Hasurim Lahasha Lahaskir? Most Rishonim learn that it means it doesn't matter what kind of keli it is. It means, does this person regularly lend them out or rent them out? So if yes, then yes. So we can talk about, for example, goats, which are something that people normally do not. Nobody lends out goats normally, because what would you lend them out for? They don't do any work. But if you have, for example, somebody, for example, a person has some female goats and he needs a male to breed with them, but ordinarily you're not going to. So most of you try to learn that Dvorim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir means we have to look at the individual. Does he usually lend out or rent out these things, or does he not? The Rambam has a shita about it, that Dvorim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir, the definition of that would be things that are to begin with made to be lent out or to be rented out. Meaning that Rambam says like this, when you get down to it, I mean, a person could lend out or rent out almost anything. A person could lend out his, a person could lend somebody his shirt. A person could lend somebody whatever. That's not, so most things are considered, but that doesn't make them dvorim asuim lahasha lahaskir. The Rambam says you have certain kinds of things that are meant specifically. People don't make them in order to use them themselves. People make them and then or buy them in the first place in order to lend them out and in order to rent them out to people. But I'm going to give some examples. For example, certain kinds of kalim that are used by certain kinds of kalim and jewelry and things like that that are used by simchas. So a modern example might be, for example, centerpieces. Nobody buys, let's say, wedding centerpieces. Nobody buys them to use in their own house. People buy them in order to have them available to lend out to people for chasanas or to rent them out or whatever. So according to the Rambam, that would be the definition of Dvorim Asurim Lahasha Lahaskir, where they're made specifically for that purpose. And so now with these centerpieces, let's say, if I own them and now some of them are in your reshus and you claim that you bought them, then we're saying that we wouldn't believe you without some kind of proof, because we would say it's much more likely that you borrowed them from me and now you're falsely claiming that they're yours. On the other hand, the Rambam learns, if it was anything else, then we would have the regular migli. The Raivad disagrees, and most Rishonim agree on that, but no, Dvorim Asurim Lahasha Lahaskir is any kind of thing that people regularly lend out, and therefore Dvorim She'en Asurim Lahasha Lahaskir would be either things like goats where nobody lends out at all because there's really no purpose, or where this particular person is known not to lend or rent them out. So anyway, the point is that, again, in the case of this knife, Abaya is going to say, since it's Dvorim Asurim Lahasha Lahaskir, however we define that, then therefore And therefore, we can't believe him that he that the knife belongs to him. Therefore, we can't use that as a basis for a migui. Meanwhile, in the case of the goats, those are dvarim she'en asuin lahasha lahaskir, because nobody lends out goats, and therefore we would believe him with a migui that it's his. So the Gemara asks for Rava less like high svara. Now, does Rava disagree with that? Doesn't Rava also agree that there's a concept that there's a difference between Dvarim Asurin, Lahasha, Lahaskir, and not? Vaharava Apik Zuga de Saibala, we find that one time Rava in a Din Torah took away a pair of scissors that are used to cut wool. Rashi says Shagozin Behen Semer that are used to cut wool, but actually there are various Kisveyad and Muka Yosef quotes Rashi this way, that it's supposed to be big date semer, that they use a saibal after all, it's not wool itself. A saibal, we find in other places in the Gemara, is a woolen garment, so it means that it's a pair of scissors that are used to trim woolen garments. Anyway, so there was such a pair of scissors, and the Sifra d'Agadda, and a Sefer of written Agadda, which is a bit unusual in itself, because in Rava's times, generally, Torah Shebaal Peh, including Agadda, wasn't written down yet. But nevertheless, here, evidently, they had written such a Sefer, as the Rava took them away, the Dvarim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir, under the conditions, for they took them away from Miyasmi, took them away from Yisoimim. He didn't consider them to be metaltalin that Yisoimim have gotten from their father, where those are usually immune against being taken by a Balhoi. We said that no, we're considering that there's definitely a chazaka that they belong to the original owner, Vidvorim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir. It wasn't in the case of a loan. It was a case where they found these things among the Yerusha, and then there were edim that it belonged to somebody else, and the reason why he took it away, Vidvarim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir, because again, these are things that are meant to be rented or lent out. Again, according to the Rambam, that would mean that these are the kind of things that regularly to begin with are not made for a person really to use himself, but rather they're the kind of thing that are made to be lent out or to be rented out in the first place, like the centerpieces. According to all the other Rishonim, it just means that it's known that these kinds of things are regularly lent out or rented out. Anyway, so we see that Rava also holds now, if the father were to be believed with a migui that he bought them, we would have to claim that on behalf of the Yisroelim, because the Yisroelim themselves don't know what possible claims to make in Beis Din about their father's estate. We Beis Din are obligated to bring up any such possible claims on their behalf. So that shows that Rava also holds of that distinction between Dvarim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir and not. The answer is Amalach Rava Hai Nami. The answer is Rava says actually as far as the knife. It's not Dvarim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir, unlike what we said that Abaya holds, Kibdim Nifgima, because after all, it becomes Niftu, doled, by using it, Kapti Inshu, very mushly. Therefore, on the contrary, people are Makbid, and they don't lend it out. So now we're back to, it's similar, Rava would say, to the goats, where they're not regularly lent out or rented out, and therefore, we can in fact say that when it's now in his possession, then he has a migui over here. He can claim that it was his, and therefore he can use that instead as a basis to claim the amount that the other guy owed him money. As opposed to so the machlokes with Abaya and Rava would basically come down to: is this in fact Dvarim Asurin Lahasha Lahaskir or not? Where Rava would hold that no, and Abaya would hold that yes, and therefore they can't use it. So in short, Rava would say he could use it as a basis for a migui, and Abaya would say that he can't. Okay. The last parak of our Masechta over here is talking most of the topics that are going to be in our parak. It's a short parak. It's only 2.5 blocks. Most of the topics in it actually belong in a way more to Bava Basra, because it's going to be talking about people who own a house in partnership, and that's the Shaykh of Bava Basra, begins with a Shutvin. But there are in this parak also dinim involving schiros, involving rent, involving rentals and hiring, which was mostly the subject of the previous parak, and therefore this is kind of a continuation of that as well. But yeah, this parak is kind of a transition to Bava Basra in a way. So the Mishnah starts off. Habayis v'haliyah shal shnayim shenafu. If you have a house and an upper floor, meaning a ground floor and an upper floor that belong to two different people. So Rashi gives a simple example. Two people, two brothers divided the estate that belonged to their father, and one of them decided to take the ground floor and the other one took the second floor. Shenafu. And now this house collapsed. Shneim choken ba'etzim va'avonim va'ofer. So now both of them end up dividing both of them divide the wood and the stones and the dirt. So now there are two different gusois in Rashi. Now the point is, the Gemara is going to establish that we have no way of knowing in this scenario whose stones were whose. We can't identify these particular stones were from the ground floor, these ones were from the upper floor. If we could, then each one would just take the ones that belong to his floor, to his story of the house. Because they can't tell, as we're going to discuss in the Gemara. Therefore we have to divide it evenly. Now there are actually different gusois in Rashi over here. Is it that Rashi is saying that no matter what now you could have, for example, when the second floor is not the same height as the top floor, as the bottom floor, it could be taller or it could be shorter. Does that mean that nevertheless we would still say they divide 50-50? There are different gusois in Rashi over here where the Rashi is saying it doesn't matter, even if they're not the same height, we still divide 50-50. Or do we say that only if they're the same height do we divide 50-50, and otherwise we're going to divide it proportionally. So many Rishonim point out that if they're the same height would they divide 50-50. And the point is that now the Gemara is going to talk about there are different ways that the house could collapse, where it's more likely that the upper stones or that the lower stones will break up. And nevertheless, the chiddush is that we don't say that the mustamo, that mustamo, the more broken ones belong to the top floor. Rather we say it's even. So we say it's an even chance, as we'll learn in the Gemara. But most Rishonim learn that it means that when do we say that the chokin, that they divided exactly equally, would be only if the two of them to begin with were the same height, and if not, then not. Meanwhile, in Rashi, many Rishonim have a girsay in Rashi that he's not saying that he's saying regardless, they need to divide it 50-50, and actually the Bach and the Maharshal actually correct the wording of Rashi to match the opinion of the other Rishonim that we divide it 50-50 only if they were the same height to begin. Anyway, so we divide it. We have to also consider which stones are the ones that more likely were broken. Meaning each one of them is going to try to claim more of the whole stones or bricks, obviously. So therefore, we have to figure out how the building collapsed, and therefore, on the basis of that, we're going to know which ones are more likely to be broken. Meaning, Rashi explains, you can have like this. If the house basically collapsed in its footprint. Now you can have, for example, like nowadays when they demolish tall buildings, they often implode them, where basically they fall onto their footprint. An example of it also would be back on September 11th when the Twin Towers collapsed. They fell, and most of the debris from them fell directly where they had been standing before. So that kind of thing, Rashi explains, usually would mean, now in that case, obviously it wasn't because something in the foundation had given way, but under normal circumstances, it would mean that something on the lower floor had given way, and therefore the bottom floor collapsed, and then the top one collapsed right on top of it. Well, therefore, the broken stones are more likely from the bottom floor. On the other hand, if the house may have fallen over, Rashi describes, like imagine a stick that's knocked over where you have, it doesn't fall in its original footprint, it falls in a different area. So then it's more likely that the stones from the upper floor are the ones that fell further away, and therefore they're more likely the ones that broke. So we have to consider that depending on how we see that the house fell, we have to see which stones are more likely to have broken. And then based on that, they're going to be able to claim the whole ones and the broken ones. And the Mishnah continues, if one of them recognized some of his stones, then he can take them, but they do count towards his total. Meaning, in other words, the other guy is going to take an equal number of stones equal to that. We're going to see in the Gemara what that last phrase means. Okay. So the Gemara starts off. Miklal midkatani royin. Since the Mishnah uses the expression further in the Mishnah that royin, we have to see how the building fell. Miklal the ikal mekam alayu. So we see, in other words, we can figure out what the cause of the collapse was in the first place. Is it that it fell because of chabsa, which means basically that the bottom floor collapsed and then the top floor therefore collapsed on it, or whether it fell by being knocked over like a stick. That's Rashi's definition of chabsa versus chabta. There are others. The Rambam has a bit of a different definition. Is it that the Rambam defines it in a way that Torah Chaim explains that the Rambam would learn that Chavta means similar to what we said, that the bottom floor collapsed and then the top one on top of it. Chabsa would be the other way around, that the top floor, the Rambam would learn that Chavta means that the bottom one, not so much that collapsed, but it moves, like the walls moved or whatever, and therefore therefore they probably stayed more whole, and then the bottom one, and then the top one fell and collapsed, and since it fell from a height, then it more likely broke, as opposed to Chavta would mean, Chavsa rather, would mean that the top floor was too heavy for the bottom ones, and therefore the bottom ones broke, and then the top one fell on top of it. So in other words, either way, the Rambam would learn that we're not necessarily talking about, like Rashi says, whether it fell in its footprint or whether it fell over like a stick, but rather in both cases, the debris is going to be there in the footprint of the building, and the question is within that itself, you can distinguish between different possibilities of how the building collapsed, whether it was the bottom that gave way first or the top. Anyway. So it sounds like from the Mishnah when it says Royin that we're able to figure out the cause. Well, Ihochi, Resha, my token. Well, then why does the Mishnah say that? Start by saying that they divided evenly, meaning that which seems to imply not only that they divide the actual stones 50-50, but they also get an equal share of the whole and the broken ones. Why? Nechzi, let's consider. If the building fell by Chabda, Iliyosa Itbur, then it means the top ones are the ones that broke, and therefore, so according to Rashi, it would mean the ones further away belong to the top floor, and the ones closer belong to the bottom floor, like we have in Chassidus, famously, you have the moshel used in many places in Chassidus, that when you have exactly that, when you have a wall that falls over, the stones that were higher up fall further away, and that's used as a metaphor for the fact that things that come from higher levels of Elikus fall deeper down and into our world. Anyway, so that would be the case if the building fell by Chavda, the Ibachabsa Nafal, and if it fell by Chavsa, meaning that it fell down, it imploded into its footprint, Tatiyose Itbur, then it would be the bottom ones that are more likely to be broken. So why is the beginning of the Mishnah saying that they divide the hole and the broken stones exactly 50-50 when the Mishnah goes on to imply that we know what the cause of the collapse was, and therefore we figure from there? And the answer is the chiddush of the Mishnah would be where the building collapsed during the night, so therefore we don't know how it collapsed. So the Mishnah would be talking about two different cases. First, it's saying chokin, that we divide 50-50 exactly as far as the hole on the broken stones, meaning where we don't know how it fell. Then when the Mishnah continues beroyin, that would be where we do know how it fell. So two different cases. Well, we want to ask, so what? It fell by night, Velasinu, but Sabra. So we look in the morning and see how the debris is lying. The answer is the panin. Meanwhile, the debris is cleared up. Well, the question is, Velasiman paninu, Velishaili. So let's find out who cleaned it up and ask him how it was in the first place. And the answer is the paninu, Bnei Rosh Hashanah, Ba'ozlo Ba'alma. The case would be that people who walk in the Rosh Hashanah cleared them away and then they left. So in other words, the building collapsed during the night. People are walking in the Rosh Hashanah, and they see this whole, all this debris over there. They can't get through. So they go and start moving the stones off to the side to get them out of their way so they can pass through. And now we find the evidence has been disturbed. They have crime scene things. The evidence has been disturbed, and now we have no way of knowing how it was in the first place. Okay, well, let's see right now whose rishus those stones are in. And then the other one is going to be, and then there's going to be a motzi mechaver levaraya. Now, obviously the implication of the question is that we assume it fell into the rishus of one of them. Tosfos compares and contrasts this with a sugya at the beginning of Bava Metzia, Bava Basra, where in that case the Gemara starts with an assumption that it's more likely it fell into the reshus of one of them. In any case, so over here especially, Tosfos says actually based on the conclusion of the Gemara over here is what the Gemara bases itself on in Bava Basra. Anyway. So why don't we say that Hamotz Machavel Aranaya? And the answer is Loitzricha the Yas from the Chotzer of Havayim. The answer is you could say that the stones and the whatnot are in the Chotzer that belongs to both of them, so neither one is more Muchsik than the other. Inami Birshus Rabim, or the stones and everything might be lying in Rishus Rabim, which is Vaita, not a Rishus that belongs to either one of them. The boys, or yet another possibility, even if they are in the Rishus of one of them, Shutin Bakai Gavna, like Kapi Adadi, we can assume that partners, given that after all they are both partners in the land, they both own the land jointly because one owns the bottom floor and one owns the top floor. So we can assume that even if it lands in a place that belongs, since they're Shutfim, they're not mafid on one another when one has his things and the other one's Rishus. So therefore, since both of them have the ability to put their stones there, therefore we can't say now when the stones are there, they definitely belong to one more than the other. So therefore that's what we're saying, that then they, if we know what the position was of the debris, then from that we can figure out how the building collapsed and figure accordingly who has more hole and who has more broken stones. But when we're saying it happened at night and the people from Rishus Rabim cleared it up, etc., then we don't have that, so then we have no choice but to have them divide 50-50. Which brings us to the next piece, which is the Mishnah had said in Hoya Echad Man Makir Chola, that if one of them recognized some of his stones, then we said he can take them, even though they're whole. And we said the question is about Lo Matoyim. Well, when Reuven is claiming that these stones are mine, what is Shimon counterclaiming? Because obviously there has to be some kind of counterclaim in order for us to even discuss what the issue is. And if he says, yes, I agree, these are yours, pshita, then obviously Reuven can take them because Shimon admits to him. The Eloi Oma'ein, and if Shimon disagrees and says, no, those whole stones are mine, Loma Noito, why should Reuven unilaterally be able to take them? Ela de Omalei Eni Yadeh. Evidently, the Mishnah has to be talking about where Reuven says, I recognize these are mine, and Shimon says, I'm not sure. Well, Levit Lema Tevit Yufta de Rav Nachman. In that case, then should we say that our Mishnah contradicts Rav Nachman? The Itmar, which we have Machlokas, which we've learned earlier in our Masechta, as well at the end of Bava Kama, it comes up in a number of places throughout Shas. Mona Libiyotcha, if Reuven says, you owe me a mona, Bahala Oima Eni Yedea, and Shimon says, I don't know, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda are going to say that he's Chayev to pay because he says, I don't know. Rav Nachman, Rav Yechanan, Ami Potter. And Rav Nachman and Rav Yechanan say that he's Potter because it's not good enough to make him pay on the, he would have to swear that he doesn't know. He would have to swear that he doesn't know, but then he would be Potter because Rav Nachman and Rav Yechanan are going to say that just the fact that the other guy is claiming, in other words, Rav Huna and Rav Yehuda take the view, Bori Veshema, Bori Odif. Reuven is claiming Bori, Shimon is counterclaiming Shema, so the Bori wins out over the Shema. Rav Nachman and Rav Yechanan say that's not good enough to take Mammon away from a person. You still need some kind of proof. Therefore, the Nitzba, the plaintiff, would be able to swear a Shavua, and he'd be potter from paying. Well, in our Mishnah, we seem to be saying that not, because we seem to be saying that the Now, when Reuven is saying, these stones are mine, and Shimon's saying, I don't know, and again, we're assuming that our Mishnah means that Shimon says, I don't know, by process of elimination, because otherwise there's no other possibility what the Mishnah is talking about. So then, the Mishnah is saying that, yes, Reuven gets to keep those stones. So the equivalent would be saying that you owe me a money and being entitled to collect the money, that would work according to Rabbi Huna and Rabbi Huda. It wouldn't work according to Rabbi Nachman and Rabbi Yochanan. Why we're mentioning Rabbi Nachman particularly, we learned about earlier in the Masechta, it could be because with Rabbi Yochanan there's another way, it could be that it means both of them, it could be because according to Rabbi Yochanan there's another way of translating it. Tosfos actually points out that anyway, Rab Nachman's basic reason is because Amotz Mechaver L'Varaya, Uki Mamona B'Chezkas Morei, the money remains in the Chazakah of the one who has it. Right now, we just said in the Gemara previously that we're talking about that the stones are located in Chesed Abim or in the Chotzer that belongs to both of them, or the Chotzer that doesn't belong to both of them, as the case may be. Whatever the case, still Tosfos says the fact is we know that half of it belongs to him, and therefore that can still be considered that he's a mukhzer. And anyway, previously when we learned this earlier in our Masechta, then we talked about Tosfos had explained over there that any time you have mumen on multiple suffix, any time you have a suffix about whom certain assets belong to, then it's considered as though they're both mukhzer. So the point is, therefore, that yes, so Rab Nachman would be saying in that case, Hamotzi Mechaber L'Varaya. So why over here would the Mishnah be saying that he can take the stones unilaterally? And the answer is, K'd'omer Rab Nachman, Gon Shiyash Esek Shvur Benehem, as Rab Nachman says in that other Sugya, that you're talking about where there's already a Shvur between them. There's already a different reason to swear, as the Gemara is going to quote in a couple of lines, what that case is. And now he's saying any idea. So in other words, there's something where he anyway needs to swear on. And now the rest of it, the rest of the claim, he's saying, I don't know. Then we say, then it's called, because he can't swear, mishalem, then therefore he has to pay, as Gemara is going to explain in the next couple of lines. The same way over here, we would be talking about, in effect, what we have is a mode of a mitzvah. He says, I admit that some of these stones, yes, you recognize and they're yours, but the rest of them, I'm not sure. The rest of the ones that you're claiming, I'm not sure about. So that would be Kidder Rava, like what Rava says. If Reuven says, you owe me a mona, now, the previous case was we had where Shimon said, on the entire mona, he says, I don't know. Where there, Rab Nachman is saying that he'd swear a Shvuas Hesus that he doesn't know, and he's potter. But here we're talking about a twist on that. Bahalo Omer, Shimon says, Ein lecha b'yadi el chamishim. I only owe you 50. Bashar eni yadeya. The rest of it I don't know about. So that's different. Mitosh eni yochali shava yishalem. There, since he can't swear, because he has to swear on the 50. He has to swear a Shvuah min HaTorah, because he's modu mitzas on the 50 that he's, on the, he has to swear a Shvuah modu mitzas. But he can't swear on it, because he's saying on the rest of it that I don't know. So therefore we say that now, because he can't swear, he pays. And there's many examples of that in Shas. There's a number of examples of those in Baba Basra and other places. Anyway, so therefore, the same way over here, if it was only, for example, there are 10 particular stones that Reuven says, I identify these as mine, and Shimon says, I don't know, then yes, Rav Nachman would say that Shimon can swear a shavur that he doesn't know, and Reuven is not necessarily entitled to those 10. But because the case is over here, that Shimon, Reuven is saying 10. Shimon says 5 of them, yes, I agree, are yours. The other 5 I'm not sure about. That would be Mitosheni, Yochel, Yishovim, Mishalim. And therefore, that would be what the Mishnah is saying, that Reuven is entitled to take all 10. Now, we said in the Mishnah of Olas Leiman HaCheshbon that they count for him towards the Cheshbon. So the Cheshbon of what? Sava, Rav Lameim, Lefi Cheshbon Shavuris. Rav thought to say that it means based on the calculation of broken ones. Meaning, in other words, Rav is thinking that what it means is that Reuven now is going to take 10 that he recognized. Meanwhile, Shimon, opposite him then, is going to have to take 10 broken ones instead. So that's a point. That's a point of action. Tosfos says that no, actually, what we would do is we would do proportionate. We would figure out that, instead, we would say, for example, here in this area from which he's picking out these 10 that he recognizes, we have in that area, let's say 10 of those, and then we have another 6, let's say, that are broken over there. So we'd say basically he's taking 10 out of 16. He's taking 10 whole and saying the rest I don't recognize. So therefore we would say, so Rava thought to say that it would mean that we'd have to do a similar proportion as far as what Shimon gets. So Shimon would end up with more broken ones than whole ones. Not that he'd end up with only broken ones, but he'd end up with more. So Alma, which would mean that Rava would hold, Shimon de Oma, any idea, when Shimon says any idea, as we just established in the previous piece of the Gemara, Riatfe, then that makes his position even worse. And therefore he winds up having to take broken ones, paralleling these whole ones. Omale Abaya, but Abaya says back, Adraba, ho Riatfe. On the contrary, you could argue that Reuben, who's claiming the whole ones, should be the one a little worse off, because Fakir, Midahani Yoda, which Fela Yoda, since he only recognizes these and he doesn't recognize the other ones too lessly, it implies that he doesn't have any other whole ones. The Idah Kola Behechnin, on the contrary, we should have more reason to argue that the rest of the whole ones belong to Shimon, because why doesn't he recognize? Why isn't it Reuben recognized? Ela Amar Abaye, Fi Cheshbon Shleimus. So what it means is, Reuben is entitled, so Shimon is going to be entitled to an equal number of whole ones. Meaning, in other words, so if Reuben says, I recognize these particular 10 that are mine, then fine, we're going to say, now when we figure out, each of us is supposed to be getting an equal number of whole and broken ones, with those 10 that you identified, those count towards your total of whole ones. Shimon is going to get another 10 that he gets outright, that are whole, and then after that, we'll go and divide up all the rest of them. So the question is, well, then what is he gaining by recognizing his stones in the first place? And the answer is the Malbin or Rabba. You might have, for example, that the bricks that he recognizes, let's say, or the stone, whatever. It's interesting, the Mishnah uses the word avonim, which are stones, because in Eretz Yisrael, they typically build with stone. In Bavel, they mostly built with bricks, and therefore the Gemara uses the word Malbina, which means bricks. Anyway, the Malbin or Rabba. Suppose that the bricks that he had are wider than the others. So therefore, so now he's saying, I recognize these wide ones belong to me. So therefore, so he is gaining that. It's true that Shimon, in return, is going to be getting an equal number of whole bricks, but at least Reuben gains that he has better quality bricks. Inami, Tina de Ma'abda, we might have, his bricks are better in that the clay for them was mixed better. So therefore, again, so you could have, it's not so much that he's gained more whole bricks or stones out of the deal, it's more that he's getting ones that are better quality out of the deal. And therefore, so he gains by that, and meanwhile, though, it doesn't mean that Shimon should lose out so much, as Rava had said, but rather we then continue to divide even. So it ends up over here, by the way, the halacha is like Abaya. Usually, of course, the halacha is like Rava over Abaya, but here, this doesn't count as one of the Al-Kagams, because, here, where it's only Sova Rava Lamema. Rava thought to say this, and after Abaya points it out differently, then it seems that Rava himself changed his mind. Okay. Mishnah says, Habayis Vahaliya, here you have another case involving a house, involving a ground floor and a second floor. Rashi explains that unlike previous Mishnah, we were talking about that they own the ground floor and the second house and the second floor respectively. One of them rented the second floor from the other, as we're going to see in the Gemara. So the truth is actually the Beis Yosef talks about that actually according to the Rambam it may well be talking about partners as well. Certain dinim that we're going to say in the Mishnah over here might to a certain extent apply to partners as well. But primarily we're talking about a Socher and a Masker, which is again what this is doing. And on the Sechta, because in the previous parak we were dealing with dinim of Socher and Masker. So then basically it would be, in other words, the previous Mishnah was just kind of to introduce this topic and to continue with dinim of Socher and Masker. Anyway, the Mishnah says, Habayis v'haliyah, so you have a ground floor and a second floor. By the way, Tosfos actually brings a gusa, Tosfos brings a gusa that, Rashi brings a gusa and rejects it, shel shnayim, that they belong to two people, like in the previous Mishnah, and Rashi says, no, again, we're not talking about it belongs to two people, we're talking about where one rented it to the other. Tosfos says that actually, even if you're talking about a renter, even if you're talking about two different people, or even if you're talking about a renter and a landlord and a tenant, you could still say shel shnayim, because each one is a separate person. Again, the Rambam or the Rifan, and the Rambam hold that we are actually talking about to a certain extent, we could be talking about two partners as well. Anyway. It's a nifcha sahalia. Suppose now that the upper floor partially collapses. So in other words, now the upper floor is not as usable as it was before. It could mean, for example, that the floor is now crooked and therefore it's not as comfortable to use. It could mean it actually collapsed and there's a hole in it, whatever. The ein bala bayis roitzel sacking. Now suppose the owner of the ground floor, or again, according to Rashi, we're talking about over here, he owns the whole place because he owns the second floor as well and he rented it out. He doesn't want to fix it. Now the one who lives in the second floor is allowed to come down and live together in the house with him until the landlord fixes the upper floor. Because basically now the one in the upper floor has no proper place to live, and he was rented this place, as we're going to see in the Gemara, exactly what the scenario is. And therefore he has the right to say, listen, I'm entitled to live in this property. And if you don't give me a second floor that I can live in, then I'm entitled to come and share the ground floor with you. This is particularly why many Rishonim are learning that we have, and Tosfos discusses and other Rishonim discuss that we have to be talking about where it's a landlord and a tenant, because then it means, in other words, the landlord to a certain extent has a shibud to the tenant. If we were talking about two partners where one of them owns the ground floor outright, and the other one owns the upper floor outright, why would the ground floor guy have the responsibility of fixing the floor between them, or the ceiling of the first floor, which is the ground, which is the floor of the second story? Why would he be more chayav to fix it than the other one? So there's discussion about that. In fact, the Ran actually brings an explanation that on the contrary, when it's partners, there's more of a reason that the ground floor guy should have to fix it. Anyway, different opinions among Rishonim and Shor, what exact scenario we're dealing with. Anyway, continues the Mishnah. Rabbi Yossi Amar Tachta Noisenas Atikra Ve'Oyenas Amaziva. Rabbi Yossi says the one who lives in the ground floor is going to have to pay for the Tikra, which is the ceiling beams. Ve'Oyenas Amaziva, the one who lives on the top floor, has to supply the Maziva, which is the plaster that's put over it to make a flooring. So in other words, unlike the Tanakhama, who had said that the ground floor person is responsible for fixing the entire thing, Rabbi Yossi divides it between them and says it depends whether we're talking about the beams versus the plaster. And the Gemara will explain why, in fact, there are. But first, the Gemara asks, Nifchas Tabakhama. When we talk about that the upper floor has partially fallen in, and we said that and we said that now he can go and live downstairs, the kama, how much of it has to have fallen in order for this din of the Mishnah to be triggered? Rav Amar Beruva. Rav says it would have to be most of the floor has sagged or collapsed or whatever. Or Shmuel Amar Ba'arba. Shmuel says it's enough if it's an area 4x4 tefachim, perhaps. Rav Amar Beruva. Rav says only if it's most of it. The reason is Al Ba'arba Loi. Rav takes the view that just as if it's an area 4x4 that has collapsed or sagged in Loi, then we would not say that he's entitled to go and live downstairs. Because it's reasonable enough that a person can live with some of his things downstairs and some upstairs. So fine, what he's going to do is, let's say, for example, so now there's an area 4x4 tefachim. He was putting one of his pieces of furniture there. Therefore, fine, he can say, for now, until you fix and to you downstairs neighbor, fix the ceiling. And meanwhile, my keli that was there in that space, I have the right to put it in your house. But he doesn't have the right to move the rest of his household effects downstairs just because of that, because the other guy can say, look, the rest of the upper floor is livable, so it's not a problem if you have to go upstairs and downstairs because of this one keli. Or Shmuel Amar Ba'aba, Shmuel said it's not 4x4 tefachim. Ein adam chetzi dor chetzi lamata v'chetzi l'mayla, because a person can't be expected to live like that with some of his things upstairs and some of his downstairs and some downstairs. And after all, the guy rented him the upper floor apartment, and therefore he's responsible to make sure that he should be able to live there in the normal way. Well, the Gemara asks Heichidami. Well, what exactly is the scenario? If to begin with, when he rented him the place, he said, I'm renting you this second floor, well then, like we learned earlier in the Masechta, Azdala, well then now, it's his mazel, that second floor is gone. So then there's no more chiyuv. So in other words, so fine, the guy will pay the rent so far for the amount of time that he lived there, and that's it, then the landlord has no further responsibility. We touched on earlier in the Masechta, Tosfos refers over here to what they discussed earlier in the Masechta. We had a case, for example, where you rented a donkey from somebody and it died halfway through the trip, where we said the other guy is responsible to get you another donkey, versus we had cases where you rented him a house and it collapsed, or you were saying you rented him a second floor and it collapsed, where you have no further responsibility. And Tosfos had drawn the distinction. When a donkey died, you typically do. You take the dead carcass and you sell it to buy another donkey, therefore you have a certain responsibility towards him to continue doing that, as opposed to when a house collapses, it's not necessarily that you're going to go and take the stones and rebuild a new house or a new second floor. So therefore he doesn't necessarily have any further responsibility. So if he said Aliyazu, then that's it. It's gone. It's his bad luck. Azza. If we're talking about that he told them to begin with, I'm renting you a second floor, well, why do we say that the tenant is entitled to come downstairs and live with the landlord and say, well, I don't have any place to live? Why shouldn't the balabas just tell him, fine, I'll rent you another second floor? It sounds like in the Mishnah, the tenant has the right to say, no matter what, I'm not obligated to take a different location. I demand to live at this location based on the terms of my lease. And therefore, if you don't have a second floor for me to live in, then therefore I demand to live on the ground floor with you. So why shouldn't the landlord be able to say, listen, I have a different second floor, it's at a different address, that's fine, you're gonna have to move, but you go and do that rather than living with me. And in fact the Ram also adds a point, The Mishnah also is implying now Tosfos had said that the tenant would have to pay for the amount of time that he had lived here. And in fact, the Mishnah seems to imply that even what happens if the tenant had prepaid for the entire year or whatever, it sounds like from the Mishnah that the master is not chayav to reimburse him for that. So why not? Shouldn't it be required then to get him a place for the rest of the year? Or maybe even if he doesn't have another one of his own, he'd be responsible to make sure that this guy has a place to live and therefore to rent him another space. Why are we saying that he should just go, that he should just go and live with him? So, in fact, Marshall also adds a point. Now, you could also argue maybe the Gemara means that the tenant should have the right to say, I have the right to live in a place by myself, on my own, not together with you, but that's not what the Gemara is asking. We haven't even gotten into the question yet of living together in the same apartment or not, but so the question would be, anyway, why does the tenant have the right to say, I'm living with you until my place is fixed? Why can't the balabas say, I'll rent you a different place? So the answer is, Omar Rav, Lo Tzricha, Do Amalei, Aliyah Zushani, Maskulach, because they put it actually into the terms of the lease. This second floor that I'm renting you, Ki Salka, as long as it's standing, Solik Bahadur, then go up and live in it, Bechinochis, and if it falls down, Chus Bahadur, then you come down together with it. Well, the Gemara says, obviously, then, a t'nai is a t'nai. So it can't be talking about that. Ela omer Rav Ashi, da omalei, aliyazu, she'al gabe, bayis ze, ani maskuloch. What it means is that when he told them to begin with, I'm renting it to you, he said this apartment, he said this second floor, but he said, which is on top of this house. By adding those extra words, which is on top of this house, it means, da shabit bayis valiyah. Means in effect, he's saying that the house is meshubad to the second floor. So therefore, if the second floor becomes unlivable, most of it according to Rav, 4x4 tefachim, according to Shmuel, then we say that now the tenant can say, well, now you are meshabed, your house, your ground floor to my second floor, therefore, since I can't live in my second floor, then therefore I'm exercising my shibud, and I'm entitled to come and take over part of your house and live together with you until it's fixed. V'chicha to Amar Ravin Barav Ada Amar Rav Yitzchak, as in fact we have a case that Ravin Barav Ada told in the name of Rav Yitzchak a similar kind of idea. Ma'ase ba'echad to Amar Lachaber. A person says to somebody else, Dolis zu sha'agavi parsek zeh ani moichaloch. I'm selling you this vine which has been trellised, which is trained on to grow on this pear tree. Or actually, a farsikim are peaches, actually. So you have now you're not allowed, you're not allowed to grow grain or vegetables together with a vineyard. That would be kalaya karen, but you're perfectly allowed to have trees grow together with vines. So here you have now a vine by itself. If you don't hold it up with something, it's going to fall, it's going to sprawl all over the ground. So what you do is you put up a fence or a trellis or any number of other kinds of things for the grapevine to train on and to grow up on it. Here there was a tree. There was a peach tree that was being used for that purpose. So he told him, I'm selling you this grapevine, which is trained on to grow up on this peach tree. The neck of the parasit, later on the peach tree was uprooted. So now the owner of the vine, the new owner of the vine, says, well, you have to supply me a new peach tree to hold up the vine. And the case came to the Priya, but Omar, and he says, yeah, yes, as long as the grapevine exists, you have to provide a peach tree for him, because you said to begin with that you're selling him a grapevine which is trained on this peach tree. So in a similar vein over here, when he said, I'm renting you this attic, this second floor, which is on top of this ground floor, then it means that he's meshabed the ground. So the same way over there, he's meshabed the peach tree to the grapevine, the same way over here, he's meshabed the bottom floor to the top floor, and therefore when the top floor becomes unavailable to live in, then therefore he can exercise his shibud over the bottom floor, and therefore we're saying he can come and live there until the top floor is repaired, until the floor of the top floor is repaired, and then he'll go back up and continue living up there. The Nemuka Yosef actually points out it's not really exactly the same thing. Here we're talking about that the second floor collapsed. Here we're saying that, let's say, for example, what he actually rented him was the second floor. In the case of the grapevine, what he sold him was the grapevine. He didn't sell him the tree. And in fact, if the grapevine were to be uprooted, he wouldn't have to supply him another one. So he explains that, still the point is that, there was a shibud over here. We're talking about again that, after all, the floor between them broke down. And in that sense, there's a shibud between them. It's true. If the attic as a whole, if the second floor as a whole fell down, then we wouldn't say the Baal HaBayis is meshubud for that. That's why we're specifically talking about where the floor between them collapsed, where therefore the floor is actually meshubud one to the other, just like the tree to the grapevine. But it is true that if the walls or the ceiling of the aliyah collapsed, that would be different. And the Baal HaBayis might not have any responsibility to supply him a new place to live because of that. Then it would be the tenant's business to find himself another place to live. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow, Beis Hashem, with more of these dinim about the two floors and about the details in our mission.